I don't always listen to podcasts, but when I do, I listen to STEM Talk, interviewing the most interesting people in the world of science and technology. Stay curious, my friends.
Welcome to STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk. STEM Talk.
STEM Talk. STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
Welcome to STEM Talk, where we introduce you to fascinating people who passionately inhabit the scientific and technical frontiers of our society. Hi, I'm your host, Dawn Cornegas, and today we have Dr. Alessio Fasano here with us. Also joining us is Dr. Ken Ford, IHMC's director and chairman of the Double Secret Selection Committee that selects all of the guests to appear on STEM Talk.
Hi, Dawn. This will be fun today. Our guest is Alessio Fasano, a slam dunk selection of the Double Secret Selection Committee.
Dr. Fasano is a leading light in the study of the microbiome. Roughly 15 years ago, Alessio and his colleagues pioneered our current understanding of the pathophysiology of celiac disease and the role of zonulin. And today, his research continues on many fronts.
There is growing evidence that the microbial content of the intestinal tract has a profound impact on human physiology, including metabolism, stress tolerance, ability to resist infection, the immune response, memory, and cognitive performance. Alessio has given several very popular lectures at IHMC, each to a packed house. Since then, approximately 70,000 people have watched his talks on YouTube, and you should too.
But before we get to today's interview, we have some housekeeping to take care of. First, we really appreciate all of you who have subscribed to STEM Talk, and we especially appreciate all the wonderful 5-star reviews piling up on iTunes. These 5-star reviews really help make STEM Talk more visible. As we announced in several earlier episodes, the Double Secret Selection Committee has been continually and carefully reviewing the iTunes reviews, with an eye toward selecting the best reviews to read on STEM Talk. There are extra points for pithiness, wit, and of course, lavish praise. If you hear your review read on STEM Talk, just contact us at stemtalk@ihmc.us to claim your official STEM Talk shirt.
Today, our winning 5-star review was posted by someone operating under the moniker N. Casuero, or something like that. As soon as we hear from N. Casuero, a STEM Talk t-shirt will be on the way.
As you will appreciate, the Double Secret Selection Committee found it easy to pick today's winning 5-star review, which has the clever title, Cognitive Satiety.
Love that title. And here is the winning 5-star review. Never have all the lobes of your brain been so satisfied. Every episode is fascinating and beautifully orchestrated. The content is interesting and diverse, that there is no room for boredom. The Double Secret Selection Committee does a superb job of keeping the listeners educated, engaged, and more intelligent with every minute. And the hosts have a linguistic seduction that you wish it would never end. I can listen to STEM Talk for hours. Thank you, and please keep the talks coming.
Wow. Thank you, N. Casuero, and the thousands of other STEM Talk listeners who have helped make STEM Talk a great success right out of the gate. Okay, now on to today's interview with Alessio Fasano.
Fasten your seatbelts and alert your microbes. The doctor is in the house.
Alessio Fasano is a world-renowned pediatric gastroenterologist and a research scientist. Dr. Fasano is chief of pediatric gastroenterology and nutrition at Mass General Hospital for Children and directs the Center for Celiac Research, specializing in the treatment of patients of all ages with gluten-related disorders, including celiac disease, wheat allergy, and gluten sensitivity. He treats patients with acute and chronic diarrheal diseases and treats infants and children who have difficult-to-treat gastrointestinal problems. Dr. Fasano also directs the Mucosal Immunology and Biology Research Center and is Associate Chief for Basic, Clinical, and Translational Research. Under his leadership, investigators are studying the molecular mechanisms of autoimmune disorders, including celiac disease and other gluten-related disorders. He has been named Visiting Professor of Pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. He authored the groundbreaking study in 2003 that established the rate of celiac disease at 1 in 133 Americans. Widely sought after by national and international media, Dr. Fasano has been featured in hundreds of interviews, including outlets such as The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, National Public Radio, CNN, Bloomberg News, and now, best of all, on STEM Talk.
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 So today I'd like to welcome Dr. Alessio Fasano to STEM Talk.
Thank you so much for having me on your podcast.
And I'd also like to welcome our co-host, Dr. Ken Ford.
Hi, Don. Great to be here with you. And hello, Alessio.
Hello, Ken. Thank you for having me again.
Oh, it's our pleasure.
So, Alessio, tell us about your childhood growing up in Italy. Were you hooked on science at an early age?
I sure was. And, you know, I had the blessing that I grew up mainly under the supervision of my grandfather. My dad and my mom, they were both working, so they didn't have really too much time. And my grandfather was retired that time. So I had, you know, the tremendous joy to spend most of my childhood more. My grandfather, there was a physicist. As a matter of fact, this guy was in Enrico Fermi's lab. And before World War II, he was a university teacher, and then he lost his job because Mussolini asked him to move to Germany, and he refused. So he was, you know, forced to teach in high school, and he ended up to teach in high school until he retired. So I remember vividly when I was a little child that sometimes I was with him in his lab, in a high school lab, doing a lot of neat stuff, and that really sparked a lot of curiosity and exploration in science, mainly physics, but then from there, you know, many other things that, you know, an inquisitive mind like my grandfather was able to really put on the grounds, and I tremendously enjoyed, you know, one-of-a-kind childhood.
That's absolutely one-of-a-kind, very unique background. So tell us about your journey to the United States. As I understand it, you originally intended to focus on eliminating childhood diarrhea as your area of research. Is that correct?
Yeah, it seems to be not a glamorous field to get in, but when I went to medical school and I learned that the major, you know, mortality was not related to cancer or, you know, to autoimmune diseases or, you know, to other chronic diseases, rather diarrhea. And at that time, you know, we still had a major toll of 5 million people that would die of diarrhea, 80% being kids. That really hooked me in this field. And again, I was fortunate enough because it's as usual, you have to be, you know, at the right time with the right people, you know, to really take advantage of what, you know, comes to your way. And that's exactly what happened at that time. I was definitely interested in internship in pediatrics and do research in that field. I didn't know yet about, you know, being interested in diarrheal diseases. There was this young fellow that just came back from the University of Chicago when he was there for a sabbatical 2 years. And he was looking for somebody that will work with him in the lab. And he was mainly focused on the physiology of the gut and how that will eventually be changed by attacks from microorganisms that can give you diarrhea. So I took the job because, as I told you, I was very much interested in making an impactful, you know, contribution in science, and 5 million, you know, casualties in pediatrics seems to be the right field to get into. And for the following few years, I really spent a tremendous amount of time to learn anything that this, you know, mentor can teach me. And by the time that I foolish myself, thinking that I knew everything, I told him I need to really learn the other flip of the coin. I know very much in depth about the guts. I want to know about microorganisms. And he said, well, the best place to learn about it, it's in the United States, it's in Baltimore. It's a place that's called the Center for Vaccine Development. You go there, spend a couple months so you can have an understanding, you know, a general understanding how microorganism works, and then you come back. Well, these 2 months became 3 years. I went back to Italy for a year and a half, and then in 1993, I turned it around and crossed the pond once again, and this was for, you know, for good, and I've been here ever since.
Very cool.
Alessio, you've previously noted that nearly 2,500 years ago, Hippocrates posited that all disease begins in the gut. The emerging understanding of the interplay between the gut microbiome, the intestinal mucosa, and the immune and nervous systems seems to support this contention. Can you elaborate a little bit on this?
Hippocrates was so right without having all the information that we have right now. But, you know, again, through this journey that I was telling you, when I start to learn about this microorganism and how they communicate with us, I was fascinated by the fact that, again, there is an ongoing discussion between us and this parallel world of microorganisms that inhabit our intestines. At that time, we didn't appreciate the complexity of this ecosystem. And matter of fact, my interest was on the specific microorganisms that, you know, give you diarrhea. But, you know, with the increase of understanding of the complexity of who really inhabits the gut, at that time, again, we didn't even know that there was, you know, this complexity of this gut microbiome. We start to really appreciate that, you know, this was something that really will have a impactful, you know, difference in who we are as individuals, human beings. And, you know, if you fast forward to the past 5 years, you know, the perfect storm of knowledge came on board and really made us to understand the importance of this ecosystem that now we call gut microbiome. And, you know, the 30 years that I spent to study how this microorganism crosstalk with us, you know, came to major use when we learned with the new techniques that whatever we're looking for 5-6 years ago was just 5% who lives in our guts. That the intestinal mucosa main function is not, as we believed before, to digest and absorb foodstuff. That is crucial, of course, but, you know, it's just part of it. You know, what is 3,000 square feet of interface, one of the most important functions in intestinal mucosa, is really to negotiate this crosstalk between us as human beings, this ecosystem, and, you know, eventually, you know, help this, you know, interaction with the environment. And, you know, if you look just at the anatomy and the physiology of the gut, now you have a better appreciation that, you know, besides digesting absorbing foodstuff, what the gut does is this continuous discussion through this exchange with the environment, you know, stuff that we like to be in our guts, i.e., you know, friends, stuff that we don't want in our guts, or foes, and how this is all orchestrated by an organ that is the most sophisticated immune organ that we have in our body, because there's the largest number of immune cells in the body, in the guts, is the most sophisticated nervous network that we have in our body. It's called the second brain, but it has more, you know, neuronal cells than the brain itself. And the fact that is at the forefront of this exchange in the environment. So, you know, the gut, it's a long tube. It's roughly 20 feet long. It's not smooth, so it's a tube that has valleys and hills, meaning that that way you increase the surface by, you know, a sixfold. And then, you know, when you zoom in even more, there are this finger-like protrusion that we call villi that increase even more the surface of the gut. And then you go on the surface of the gut that is covered by single layer cells, epithelial cells that we call enterocytes. And they have themselves on the top, on the face of the lumen, microvilli. So when you multiply all this, you know, amplifying surface, you end up with a surface that covers roughly double tennis courts, so roughly 3,000 square feet. And again, at the beginning, we thought that this was simply to increase the interface to digest and absorb food stuff. Now we know that the key elements is to interface with the environment. In other words, decide if and when stuff comes in, and how we do that. And these epithelial cells, they don't do this in a vacuum. They do this orchestrating these decisions with other elements, starting with this wealth of immune cells that, you know, are residing in intestine. And intestine is, you know, the organ that has the richest number of and variety of immune cells, starting from the dendritic cells. They are specialized cells that can send periscopes into the lumen to check who's there, if they're friends or foes. B cells, they are specialized immune cells that can create weapons that we call immunoglobulins. Some of them can be shot into the lumen what we call the secretory IgA. So you fight, you know, the enemy outside the wall of the city, so to speak. And then these T cells, very specialized cells, that they eventually create a tremendous amount of collateral damage. It's called inflammation. And sometimes, you know, these immune cells, they stay on the battlefield, and therefore the inflammation materializes there. And sometimes they are programmed to go in any part of the tissue and organ and tissues in the body and create inflammation somewhere else. And that's the reason why, as Hippocrates said, you know, everything starts from the gut just because of that. All this is in order to orchestrate all this. So in other words, coordinate the function of the epithelial cells, the function of immune cells, you need a maestro orchestra, and that's the nervous system. And the number of nervous cells in the gut, it's astronomically high, higher than in the brain itself. And that's really coordinates all these functions, digestion, absorption, antigen sampling, and inflammation versus tolerance, peristalsis, and all, in other words, the key function that intestine does. And sometimes they use messengers to do that. There is not just the nervous signal, but hormones, so that, you know, a different part of the intestine, far from where the discussion is occurring, may eventually be made aware what's going on, and therefore will be prepared for the next step of this crosstalk discussion. Now, again, all this needs to be put in consideration the fact that through this tube of 20 feet long and goes from mouth to anus, there are a wealth of molecules. Some that we definitely want to be there because our friends, like foodstuff and good bacteria that can be living with us in symbiosis, and foes, stuff that can be very detrimental to us, some chemicals, pollutant, you know, enteric pathogens or microorganisms that can really create a major problem for us. So imagine all this decision-making on a daily basis, what kind of network that implies. And to do that, the epithelial cells, they have sensors on their surface, what we call technically pattern recognition receptors, that will really sense who is in the lumen. If they're friends, so it means I'm okay, stay put, don't do anything. Or if they're foes, then you have to prepare for war.
STEM Talk is an educational service of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, a not-for-profit research lab pioneering groundbreaking technologies aimed at leveraging and extending human cognition, perception, locomotion, and resilience.
Alicia, so a substantial part of one's microbiome is established at birth via maternal transfer. And it would seem that this might be very advantageous as, in a sense, this initial microbiome is custom fitted to the newborn child. Can you elaborate a little bit on this? And where else do we get the rest of our microbiome as we go through life?
Well, you know, I have to say that the last news is that you don't get the establishment of the microbiome at birth. It starts even in the woods. This is brand new information that we really learned in the past few months. So it sounds like, and that the last trimester of pregnancy, mom is able, through this specialized immune cells that we call dendritic cells, that they have the capability to put periscopes in the lumen to sample good bacteria, bring them in, and through the circulation, the placenta, deliver them in the baby's gut, still in the womb, the last trimester. So you have an initial imprinting there. And then the major imprinting happened at birth through the passage of the birth canal. So that, you know, microorganisms, they've been selected to live in peace with mom because genetically compatible in this crosstalk, and therefore most likely also ready to have a friendly discussion with the baby that genetically similar to mom, are delivered, you know, either because they were inhabiting the vaginal canal or inhabiting the intestinal canal. So they come both at birth and will have this major initial imprinting. That's the reason why it's advantageous to be born by, you know, natural delivery. And that's the reason why it's advantageous to be born full term and not preemie, because these two elements, initial imprinting during the last trimester of pregnancy, and then the ones at birth can occur. And, you know, when you have this kind of initial imprinting, now you have this syndicate to have the inhabitants that will be friendly and living in symbiosis with us. Of course, this is just the beginning. Then there are other elements that need to occur in order to really establish the very protective microbiome, starting from how this baby is fed. Breastfeeding contains some elements, particularly some sugars that we call human mono-oligosaccharides. They are very rich in the breast milk, totally useless to feed the baby. But the baby cannot make use of these, you know, sugars. The only function that they have is to feed the right and good microbiome. So if you're, you know, fed by, you know, breastfeeding, you will have an advantage compared if you're fed by bottle, because the you know, the cow's milk does not have these sugars. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, when the baby food is introduced, the way that this is introduced and the kind of food that is introduced also will guide the final touch and the composition of this microbiome. Then the first year of life is very erratic, changed dramatically, and then settled by the end of the first year in a more stable microbiome. The current knowledge that we have is that the first 1,000 days of life are absolutely instrumental to really set, you know, this, you know, crosstalk between us and the microbiome in the right direction. Really, if we go back phylogenetically, we need to appreciate that the immune system was built, quote unquote, by evolution to fight a single enemy: microorganisms. You know, our ancestors 2 million years ago would die either because, you know, infections or a predator will eat them. It's only recently, very recently, by the way, that the immune system has to fight so many other enemies, like pollutant chemicals, radiation, cancer, autoimmune diseases, and so on and so forth. And a matter of fact, you know, when the immune system deployed weapons, the collateral damage, i.e. inflammation, is nothing else, an environment in which microorganisms, they are not happy to, you know, be in there because they cannot thrive. They cannot grow in there. So it should not come as a surprise that during this first 1,000 days, the microbiome is the one that teaches the immune system to work properly, to defend us rather than to be detrimental. A good trainer, so a good balanced microbiome, a microbiome that's been inherited because the baby is born at terms, been fed with breastfeeding, that has been, you know, receive a nutrition that is, you know, real food and not the stuff that we feed now our babies nowadays. No infections, no antibiotic treatment. So in other words, a good balanced microbiome is the one that will teach the immune system to set the bar to unleash this inflammation very, very high. So when we really, really are under major danger. An unbalanced microbiome, the one that is established because, you know, again, you're born preemie or by C-section, a lot of infections, a lot of antibiotic use during these first 1,000 days of life, and most importantly, because of all these elements, the most important is nutrition. Fed the Western diet, that is not the way that we evolved, will set this microbiome off balance and therefore will teach the immune system to unleash this inflammation even when it's not needed. So very low threshold. And on a specific genetic background, this will put you at risk for tremendous consequences of chronic inflammatory diseases, even in your adulthood and your elderly years.
Alessio, as you have just described, we're learning more and more about the gut as a transducer of the outside environment to the human body. And as you said, it really drives home the importance of nutrition and lifestyle and overall health. You have this wonderful piano analogy for the epigenetic interplay of the microbiome and our human elements, genes. Could you share that with us?
Well, with great pleasure, because, you know, again, in the journey to try to solve the disease humankind, many years ago, we embraced in this human genome projects. The goal was, again, to find all the genetic signature of humankind, and therefore to find the key to solve the disease that we're suffering for. And it was a major disappointment when we realized that we are made by only 23,000 genes now. It's been downgraded even more. And most of them are shared with other animals. You know, only 400 genes differ us from chimpanzees, and 95% of our genome is identical to a mouse. And again, you know, this was a major disappointment, and my self-esteem went down to the toilet when I learned that, you know, to stay in the GI world here. And the reason why, you know, again, we are really at the bottom of the genetic sophistication of inhabitants on face of Earth. You know, the worm that we go fishing with has 75,000 genes. Plants that make grains like wheat, they have 150,000 genes. And again, how do you explain that? Well, first of all, we were not supposed to be the dominant species on the face of the Earth. It took a meteor shower that, you know, eliminated our predators so that we can jump from the trees down on the ground. And from there, to use, you know, two of our extremities to walk, and the other two that were free up for our more creative, you know, activities. But still, you know, to move from, you know, a disadvantaged species to the dominant one, it took a total different kind of approach. And that is the fact that, again, the original proposition, one gene, one protein, one disease, it really don't fit the bill here. What fits the bill is indeed that these 23,000 genes are like a sort of piano, and you need a piano player. So that, you know, these 23,000 genes can be played at different combination, different times. And now you have an infinite, infinite possible of combinations. And it turns to be that the piano player is nothing else than the microbiome. The microbiome is the one that transduces all the environmental pressure on us. Because no matter if you're talking about climates, you're talking about lifestyle, you talk about, you know, where do you live, the traveling attitudes, what you eat, and so on and so forth. Ultimately, all this will impinge on the microbiome. And the microbiome, as a complex in terms of genetics, 150 times the one that we do. And, you know, it is the pressure of the genes for the microbiome that cross-talk with our genes, tell them if and when to express or repress their activities, meaning when you play these notes. And that means that, again, you can really have not only infinite possibilities, but there is another implicit, you know, concept of what I just told you. We were under the impression that if we're born with the genes, let's say, to develop Alzheimer's or, you know, multiple sclerosis or cancer, that was destiny. Sooner or later, this is going to come on up upon us. It's not true. If we will have these conditions to move from genetic potential to clinical actuality, it all depends on our lifestyle that eventually impinge on the microbiome that by epigenetic pressure decide if and when these genes will be turned on. So the fact that I have the genes, for example, to develop Lou Gehrig disease is not a destiny. If I do or do not, it really depends on the way that I live my life.
It would seem like in many cases one would hope for a piano player with short fingers.
Well, you know, again, you know, until the reason passed, we were at the mercy of destiny, who's going to play our piano. But the future is really, you know, looking forward a possibility to decide who's going to sit and play our piano. This is, again, was not even a possible proposition until the recent past. But now that we have the capability to understand who is the piano player that lives with us, now there is a possibility with the technology and the cost and now much more affordable, one, to learn what kind of piano we have. So how many, you know, notes can be, you know, defective that will lead to whatever disease. So we have the capability by the whole genome sequencing to understand what kind of genetic background we have. And then with the techniques that, you know, are evolving, so we can actually answer three questions about the microbiome. Who is there? So in other words, what kind of piano player I have, what kind of music this piano player is capable to play. Is a classic piano player? Is a pop piano player? Is a jazz piano player? And most importantly, because that's the most important one, what kind of music this piano player is playing as we speak? And then do mathematical modeling as following these cohorts of people that eventually are at risk for these diseases. We can predict if there is a certain piano player that is playing certain music, sooner or later, you will end up with that kind of, you know, clinical outcome. And therefore, because we cannot manipulate our genes, we may eventually be able to manipulate our, you know, microbiome and the capability to play specific, you know, songs so that we keep ourselves healthy for much longer period of time. So what I just described is what we call primary prevention, or we can, you know, eventually stratify the population and have, you know, precision medicine and really do, okay, this subgroup of people, they have this disease, will benefit for this intervention that will change the microbiome this way so that this will resolve the problem. You appreciate here that this takes a lot of modeling. And, you know, institutions like IHMC will be instrumental to helping us in modeling, you know, so that we can predict.
This whole area of the interaction between our genome and the microbiome is the part that I find most interesting and most hopeful for the future. I mean, it explains the riddle of how a simple genome produces such a highly differentiated and complex animal, and also opens up complete new pathways for both medicine and human performance and resilience.
I'm pretty sure that Galileo Galilei was saying the same when he was doing science, but I have to say this is the best time to be in science. You know, the knowledge now is so deep, the technology is advancing so fast that I can even not predict what's going to happen in 2 years from now in the field. But, you know, this riddle can, as you were mentioning, now start to be intelligible to us, and we can eventually, now that we know the toy, start to play with it and try, you know, to turn, you know, the story and the destiny to our advantage.
As Heinz Pagels and others have said, we make our tools and then they make us. And this is a is a great example of that.
That's right.
Yeah, and it sounds like we're kind of a super organism, the product of two genomes that work together, the human genome and then also the genome that's associated with our microbiome. Pretty cool.
Absolutely. And again, you know, one, we can't do anything about it. The human genome is inherited from mom and dad, will never change. So if you got it, you got it. So if you have a defective piano player, you can't trade it anymore. They are too expensive. But the other one, you know, the genome associated with microbiome, it's really up to us really to keep this in a compatible, a friendly cross this talk and discussion. So we play the music that we like, the music of health. And this really boils down to our lifestyle. There is no much other than, you know, a simple rule here. You know, the way that we live will dictate the destiny that we have. Mm-hmm. So this is really in our hands to really play the game accordingly.
Another great reason why it's so much nicer to be a human than an earthworm. You know, from a computer scientist's point of view, this makes tremendous sense, right? If you want infinite flexibility and variability, or nearly infinite, it's a very big number. When you look at the potential crosstalk between the huge genome associated with the microbiome and our relatively small genome, the potential computational complexity is huge, much more than any large genome could provide.
Absolutely. And again, when modern nature designed to engineer this, I'm telling you, this is mesmerizing. And, you know, any computational, you know, engineer will appreciate the beauty and the simplicity of how this really was obtained, given the fact that you have a limitation in terms of the number of genes that you can put in the human genome. This was fascinating.
Absolutely.
STEM Talk is an educational service of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, a not-for-profit research lab pioneering groundbreaking technologies aimed at leveraging and extending human cognition, perception, locomotion, and resilience. So, Alicia, let's back up a little bit to the early 2000s. You were the first researcher to uncover the pathophysiology of celiac disease and the role of a factor called zonulin. Can you explain the interaction between gluten, zonulin, and inflammation?
Sure. You know, at that time in the 2000s, the recipe for chronic inflammatory diseases, including autoimmunity like celiac disease, was conceptualized to have two ingredients: genes that you're born with, so you have to be genetically predisposed, and then an environmental trigger that will eventually create the syndicate to have an inflammation that will turn against yourself. So in other words, the immune cells that are there to defend against these enemies will start to attack your own body. But the question at that time that nobody was able to really explain was how these two worlds, genes that live in our body and these enemies that in general, large molecules, proteins, they live outside of our body, can physically interact in order to make this happening. And again, this was not explained by classical immunology. They just brush it off by saying, well, this has happened somehow, but that's the end of the story. And during my training in Naples, as I was telling you, as a gut physiologist, one thing that I learned big time was that this long tube with a single layer of cells was built to make sure that nothing big would come through. So in other words, at that time, we considered this single layer of cells like a sort of floor with which each cell was a tile, and everything in between cells was cemented by this grout, so that all the discussion between us and the environment had to be negotiated through the cell. Mm-hmm. And then in the mid-70s, this Japanese group said there is no grout or cement in between cells. There are gates almost all the time closed, but that implies that sometimes this can be open. And over time, the complexity of these gates became extremely sophisticated and redundant. And ruling biology, that sophistication, redundancy means that function is extremely important. And people start to appreciate that this pathway in between cells is one of the pathways that is very important to do what we call antigen sampling. So to understand our surrounding and make sure that we stay put without, creating too much inflammation. One information that was missing was, okay, now they know there is a gate. Who is opening it? Where is the key? And that's when celiac disease became extremely useful to us, because we learned through celiac disease that beside the genetic predisposition, the exposure to an environmental trigger that is known for celiac disease, that is molecule from grains like wheat that is called gluten and gliadin, there is a third element that is necessary: loss of this barrier function that will eventually allow this large molecule gliadin to come in and create inflammation. What was not clear was, okay, what is the key? Who opens this gate? And thanks to the studies in celiac disease, we stumble upon this molecule zonulin that is a key that allows these gates to be open. And when it's done under physiological circumstances, it's a very, very useful pathway. And because we're not supposed to eat gluten as human beings, as a matter of fact, gluten just came 10,000 years ago with the advent of agriculture. The more we study this pathway, the more we learn that gliadin, by mistake of evolution, is impinging on some mechanisms that we turn on when we are under attack by bad microorganisms. So in other words, gliadin is perceived by our immune system as a component of a microorganism, and therefore triggers the same kind of pathway, including the release of zonulin that we use indeed to defend ourselves against these enemies. And, the rest is history. Now, zonulin has been linked not only to celiac disease, but many other autoimmune diseases like MS, Crohn's, type 1 diabetes, and a series of neurodegenerative diseases like schizophrenia, autism, and also a series of cancer like brain cancer, breast cancer, and pancreatic cancer.
That's really interesting. So I understand that lorazepide acetate, which is a zonulin receptor antagonist, is in phase 3 clinical trials right now. Can you tell us a little bit more about this promising peptide and also its progress through the very arduous drug discovery process?
You know, I can embellish myself by saying, oh, yeah, we thought about this, engineered this receptor antagonist so that we can have a solution to autoimmunity. But it's far from truth. You know, again, you know, science progress is always an act of serendipity. You know, the vast majority of the time, you know, discoveries, particularly, you know, what we call transformation discoveries, happen by mistake. Matter of fact, you know, we were, you know, going back to my early days that I was interested in diarrheal diseases, I was trying to develop a vaccine for cholera that was a complete failure and very disappointing. And, you know, in a situation like this, you either give up and do something else or you start to inquire why that did not happen. And, you know, in trying to figure out why this vaccine failed, we end up to discover a toxin in Vibrio that indeed makes the intestine leak. And by trying to understand the mechanism how this toxin does this, we understood there was extremely complex machinery that we have in place to regulate the space in between cells. And therefore, we reasoned that, you know, this cannot be due just to be the target of the toxin, but more likely cholera was mimicking something that we do for a living. And that's how we conceptualized the existence of zonulin. Mm-hmm. And when zonulin was discovered, we thought that zonulin, this toxin, will impinge on the same machinery. And therefore, we look at the structure of these two molecules. We found an overlap region. And this overlap region was of 8 amino acids. And we reasoned, well, maybe that, you know, this is the way that, you know, this toxin and this zonulin engage with the cell to communicate to open these gates. So we generate this synthetic peptide just to make sure that this hypothesis was correct. Indeed, it was. So by using this peptide, we block both zonulin and this toxin activity so that we prevent the intestinal gut leak. And from there, then we said, wait a second, when we realized that zonulin was involved in so many diseases, we thought, well, what about if we use this peptide to stop this, you know, inappropriate, you know, gut permeability? And that's how lorazepam came aboard. So it was not meant at all to go all the way to a phase 3 trial as it is right now. So this is the nutshell to tell you, you know, a good scientist, you know, has to go through a training and so that you learn, you know, how to design, interpret data. And, you know, what we do for a living is, you know, we, you know, conceptualize an hypothesis, we design an experimental design to challenge it, and then we execute. But 9 out of 10 times, the outcome is very different what we predicted. And again, you know, there is incremental science. You go from point A to point B, point B to point C, and that's when the hypothesis is confirmed. So your peers, they see where you start, you see where you go. Everybody's happy. You are able to publish and that kind of stuff. But again, when you go from point A to point Z, in a place nobody has been there, most of the time you got in a dead end, but when you got to something really new, you have, you know, a story like this zonulin story that is really transformational, open new paradigm of science. And it's very, very hard, of course, to validate that. And it takes years, and it took 15 years for this scientific establishment to accept, you know, the zonulin story that now, by the way, is all the way to phase 3 trial.
Yeah, it's really interesting because when I was a postdoctoral researcher in the area of acute brain injury, we were hearing more and more about the role of zonulin in blood-brain barrier integrity following injury. Do you think that zonulin could also potentially play a role in what we are learning more about the gut-brain axis and the relationship between the gut microbiome and brain health?
Oh, I'm very biased in answering. Absolutely, yes. Well, the fact there is a crosstalk between the brain and the gut, yeah, and vice versa, I believe, is not an object of discussion anymore. And the fact that sometimes this crosstalk can go out of balance and create pathology also, I believe, is not an object of discussion. Now, you know, it's intriguing that the first discovery of zonulin happened in the gut, of course, because we were going after something that, you know, was from a pathogen like Vibrio. But soon after, I mean, in a matter of a few months, we realized the receptor zonulin were present in the blood-brain barrier as well, and on endothelial cells throughout the body, the kidney, and so on and so forth. So we were intrigued by this. So it looks like that zonulin has a function to negotiate the interaction with the environment when you're at the forefront on a gut, but also is able to modulate trafficking between body compartments inside of our body, including the blood-brain barrier. And, you know, other groups, particularly from Germany, were able, for example, to link production of zonulin, breach the blood-brain barrier, and tumors like gliomas, to the point in which they found that the more advanced stages the glioma, the more the barrier is compromised, the more zonulin was produced in the blood-brain barrier. You know, now we start to see, you know, something extremely interesting in that vein with autism, autistic spectrum disorder, for example, because a lot of autistic kids, they have GI upsets, and this seems to be due to this gut-brain axis. And, you know, people, they start really to focus on what is the role of the microbiome in creating these conditions in which eventually when you have an unbalanced microbiome, you will eventually create a syndicate of either activated immune cells that migrate in the brain and create neuroinflammation that leads to, again, schizophrenia, autism, or on the other hand, the microbiome by itself produce some metabolites that are now having a direct effect on the brain and therefore change, you know, the clinical outcome depending on who genetically you are.
That's a good stuff. You said there are two primary predictors of scientific success, humility and perseverance, and that failure is often routine with very few successes spiked in between. Can you talk a little bit about this?
I can write textbooks on this, given my tremendous number of, you know, failures. And, well, you know, the reality of the story is that, you know, everybody that is in science knows that the truth of today is the garbage tomorrow. We refurbish the entire knowledge in science every 5 years. When I start this journey, would take 10 years. And I'm pretty sure soon it will be much shorter than 5 years. So, again, if I stumble in my close world of my preconcept, dogmas, I would not be a good scientist. You need to put yourself in discussion all the time. If you decide that, you know, this is the way the stuff goes and you are not, you know, open-minded enough to change your way of thinking, I mean, sooner or later you will find yourself, you know, out of business. Now, lesson learned from my grandfather, to go back to the beginning of our discussion here, he was the kind of person that say, you know, if you want immediate success, science is not your field. There is no something like, you know, immediate rewards. You plant the seed and then you wait. And, you know, again, you have to have the humility to question yourself all the time. And you have to understand that, you know, science, and that's what I learned, it's really a constellation of failures with very few successes. And we live for those. How bored would be if every single experiment that we do will succeed? This would not be really fun at all. But on the other hand, you know, if you don't have that kind of capability to really postpone, you know, the rewards and the patience to wait for you those successes, you are in the wrong field. You know, if you want immediate rewards, you have to go to Wall Street and be a, you know, somebody that makes money that way. But again, you know, because all these, you know, failures, as in my opinion, and has been my observation, that the best predictor of good scientists is perseverance. So you need to keep going and never give up. You know, when I, you know, did this vaccine for cholera, I spent 2 years. I was absolutely sure that that vaccine was going to work. He did everything that was supposed to do in animal models, in the preclinical trials, and so on and so forth. And when we gave to volunteers, and these people, they still have diarrhea, that was a major, major blot. I mean, really, 2 years of science, hard work, flushing the toilet of these people that have diarrhea. And, you know, at that point, if you don't persevere, you just give up. And the Zolan story would never materialize.
Yeah, actually, I had a sign that sat above my desk as a postdoc that one of my graduate mentors gave to me, and it said, "Brick walls are there for a reason. They make you prove how badly you want something."
Exactly.
It's a reminder.
Exactly. Yep, exactly.
So, Alessio, do you think there's a difference between the U.S. and Italy in terms of the way that science is pursued and practiced?
Oh, absolutely. Unfortunately, there is. Science in Italy is a hobby. So despite that, again, I can go through a laundry list of now unbelievable scientists in the past 1,200 years. At the time that the great scientists really had Italy as the mecca of science, they had mentors and benefactors that appreciate, that there was value added, and they invest in these people. Now, Italy invests less than, 2% of their overall, revenues to science. So there is no way that Italy can keep the pace with the competition of countries like U.S. that consider, science as an investment. And that's the reason why, it's not unusual that bright people are, sometimes forced to move in the United States to really unleash their creativity and make a difference. Now, again, thankfully, because now we're global village of science, with the way that we now communicate and interact, as we do now, for example, you guys in Pensacola, I'm in Boston in real time, we can do this in science as well. So the story is changing a little bit. So, I believe that the Italian scientist has all the rings and bells to be at the forefront of discoveries. But again, it's like a good seed that's really planted the wrong, ground. The European community is trying to change that. And hopefully, slowly but surely, we will see some change in that sense.
I don't always listen to podcasts. But when I do, I listen to STEM Talk, interviewing the most interesting people in the world of science and technology. Stay curious, my friend.
How often do you make it? Excuse me, ask that over. It's the proverbial frog.
Creeping in here.
Yeah, we have a frog that jumps in our throats here. Frog doesn't like it. No, I hope no epigenetic interaction, though, with the frog. Okay.
That would be a very complex organism.
It'd be a worrisome organism. How often do you make it back to Italy, and can you talk a little bit about your activities there?
Yeah, actually, recently, in the past 3-4 years, more often than the past. And the reason why, because now we have a program there. We opened a research institute in Salerno, that is the city where I was born, that is called the European Biomedical Research Institute in Salerno, or EBRIS. This is an interesting project because I don't know if you're aware, but Salerno was the site where the first Western medical school was established in 863. So 150 years before Bologna, that is the longest standing Western medical school, and almost, 250 years before Montpellier and so on and so forth. Interesting story. And there was a legend that this, school was established there by a combination of Greek, Latin, and Hebrews, scientists, philosophers, healers. And the site where this was happening was supposed to be in a very specific spot in Salerno that coincided with an old monastery. And a few years ago, the mayor of Salerno asked me if I was interested to help to renovate this building that was pretty much now in decadence, using some European community money to set up a research institute. And I was intrigued by the fact. But I knew this was a legend because, this monastery did it half a millennia, later than the establishment of the school. Long story short, got this money, got an engineer from United States, we started to do this work and look at the foundation to make sure that the building was still sound. And sure enough, we found underneath, another church that predated 700 years of the monastery. And there were some excavation finding in which we found pools that collect water from a nearby spring for the treatment of rheumatism that were described in the textbook of the Scuola Medica Salernitana. And we found also chambers in which they channeled, you know, steam for the treatment of asthma. So bottom line, this is the real place. And you know, just to give you a sense of how important this place, this was the first medical school that had a textbook of medicine, the first medical school that gave an official diploma to become a doctor. The first female faculty was there throughout the Ruggiero in 1893. So we're talking about 1,000 years before that women were given, again, the rights to be, present in academia. And she wrote the textbooks of OBGYN that still stands strong in some of the principles. So, and because of the Mediterranean area, because that I really do believe that nutrition is the key elements to shape the microbiome and therefore our destiny, this institute is mainly focused on nutrition and health.
Yeah. Would you like for us to come over and visit and collaborate with you over there? We'd be happy to do so.
Delighted to. The spot is not bad. It's on the Mediterranean Sea, overlooking Capri Island at the beginning of the Amalfi Coast, 50 miles southern Pompeii. So that's not a bad spot. So anytime, guys, anytime.
Thank you.
When I was in the Navy, I had a job in Naples. And I remember Salerno, beautiful spot.
Yeah, it's getting even better. So definitely you guys need to make a trip over there.
We look forward to collaborating. So what's been your biggest adjustment living in the U.S.?
Lifestyle, for sure. Again, in Italy, people, they work to live. Here are the people, they live to work. So it's too much workaholic attitude here. The capability to really get out and see people and socialize on a regular time and not that, 8 o'clock, everybody's locked in their places with some exception, of course. It was a major adjustment. Food, of course, nevertheless to say that, particularly at the beginning, I could not really adjust to the fast food. I'm a strong proponent of slow food. That is the way to go. So for us, a meal is a matter of hours and not minutes. Going to a drive-in to get some food is something that is totally inconceivable, even nowadays in Italy. Climate, I was born in the south. Never saw snow in my life, other than when I went north to go skiing. And now, particularly in Boston, I got my share of snow. But those were the biggest adjustment. On the other hand, there are some stuff here that I absolutely adore. It's really the limit is the sky. There is no negotiation that you have to go through to really, materialize where your potentials. If you want something and you want that strongly, sooner or later this will materialize in the United States, and that's not the case in Italy.
Well, Alicia, time has absolutely flown by. Thank you so much today for the wonderful interview. Really enjoyed it.
Sure, that was really great stuff, Alicia, and I hope that you will visit us again at IHMC sometime soon and bring along your wonderful son, Stefano, again.
Well, we will definitely consider that because every single time that I come down to visit your institute, I have, absolutely great time, and you guys all the time are able to really amaze me with your discoveries and new toys that you made over there.
Well, the feeling is mutual, you can be assured.
Thank you for having me again.
STEM Talk.
Wow, that was a fantastic chat with Alicia Fasano.
Agreed. He is really at the very front of one of the hottest topics in medicine and health. Beyond the role of the microbiome in disease and wellness, we humans appear to be a kind of super organism. As we heard from Dr. Fasano, humans and our microbes have developed a fascinating codependency, which affects nearly all aspects of wellness and human performance, including the expression of our genes.
I invite you to visit the STEM Talk webpage where one can find the show notes for this episode and learn more about Alessio Fasano and also find a link to his excellent book, Gluten Freedom, stemtalk.us. This is Don Cornegas signing off for now.
And this is Ken Ford saying goodbye until we meet again on STEM Talk.
Thank you for listening to STEM Talk. We want this podcast to be discovered by others. So please take a minute to go to iTunes to rate the podcast and perhaps even write a review. More information about this and other episodes can be found at our website, stemtalk.us. You can also find more information about the guests we interview.